Convención Constitucional, Constitutional Convention option, which is currently pulling ahead, though the fact that Rechazo folks can vote as well on this question makes the outcome of that uncertain. I think Chileans have faith in each other. All that they have accomplished, the unity that they have built in the streets, gives them, they inspire one another tremendously and have tremendous hope. All indications are that this will be a free and fair election. It's good to remember that Augusto Pinochet was removed by a referendum in 1990. So it's an end to privatization, it's an end to this neoliberal regime, and it's representation that is representative of not only the wealthy, but of all Chileans. And now the issue of Mapuche sovereignty coming to the forefront, will there be resolution for 500 years of oppression and targeted genocide against this racial minority?
That was Joshua Tucker in Santiago, Chile, covering last weekend's protests and the upcoming constitutional referendum. Josh's recent coverage can be found on the YouTube channel Seri Disidentes. English voiceover for this program was provided by Savannah Ray Jones. From KVU News, I'm Ethan Sandlis.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station, meet candidates running for four open board seats, and participate in a lively discussion about KBOO in the year 2020 and beyond. Featuring performing artists Scooter Rogers, Rain Ezra, and host Trista Tyree. To get the link for the meeting, register online by visiting our website kboo.fm/meeting2020. That's kboo.fm/meeting2020.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race, with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about
race.
Race.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race. This is our trick or treat show. The treat, making society better, or offering you free medical procedures, or getting your probation shortened, or your criminal sentences shortened. The trick.
You are sterilized.
Your uterus is removed, or you have a vasectomy. Forced sterilization is back in the news. For undocumented human beings, people of color, women who were incarcerated, and men to reduce their prison time. We do not need to make up horror stories when our history in America, past and present, is terrifying enough. Let's talk about race. Trick or treat. Forced sterilization continues in America. Now we're going to transition into our main topic, trick or treat. We want to start with Professor Johnson. The treat is that you're going to get free medical care. The trick is that they remove your uterus. What's going on here, Professor Johnson? Trick or treat?
Yes, that is quite a trick. the news really brings this up, involuntary sterilization of women that are being held in detention centers and the recent whistleblower around that. But there is some framework, I think, with involuntary sterilization to really understand it as something that impacts people of color primarily. And it has quite a history in this country. It was surprising to learn that the Nazis actually got some of their ideas from the work that was being done in California on sterilizations. So legally, the case was set by a Dr. Albert Prideaux, and he ran the Virginia colony. And he used as his test case a person by the name of Carrie Buck. Her father left her and her mother. Her mother had no means of taking care of her. And so this family adopts her, but they adopt her and raise her in servitude, with to have her work in servitude, not just for them, but also for the community, other families, wealthy families. So a family member rapes her. She becomes pregnant. So they say that she's a moron, that she's amoral, and they institutionalize her. That's where she's in the hands of this Virginia colony. They, once institutionalized, they diagnose her as what's called a middle grade moron. She has her child, and they classify the child as a moron as well. And they say that she poses a threat. She's a danger to society because she will breed more morons. Morons that they would eventually have to execute because they get in the criminal system or institutionalized because they become problematic for society. So that was the legal case that went to the Supreme Court. And in an 8-1 decision that was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of our great historical jurists, forced sterilization became legal. And under that decision, they estimate there's been between 60 and 70,000 sterilizations that happened. So that was in 1924, and that's just a little background. But the thinking of these people that were practicing what's called eugenics, and actually the etymology of that word came from Charles Darwin's half-cousin, who felt that this was just advancing Darwin's Darwinian theory, and that they were helping nature along by producing this master race of people and getting rid of people that were deemed unfit. And it's important because it affects not just the practice of sterilization, but it became very much a part of the decisions around immigration. And that's where we got quotas for immigration from what we considered undesirables. Think about that. Anne Frank was not able to come to this country because of those quotas. So in a sense, because she's Jewish, undesirable, you know, they set limits on who could actually migrate here. Think about some of how the U.S. changed from send me your tired and, you know, masses to we're only going to accept certain groups of people. And one of these eugenicists, I guess you would call them, said that the central mission of all politics is race hygiene. And that was a biologist, Harry Laufman, who ran the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories, which was a eugenics establishment. So that just provides some background to think about this within the context of eugenics and what is happening to these immigrants, these women at the border, where they are continuing to sterilize women of color and what some of the motivation of that might be. Additionally, they're continuing to sterilize women in the prison system in California, there's still cases going on. This is primarily affecting Black women and Latino women of color.
Over 4 years, female inmates in California were illegally sterilized without the required approval from the state. The Center for Investigative Reporting says almost 150 women received tubal ligations between 2006 and 2010. And citing state documents, the center says there could be as many as 100 more going back to the late 90s. Between 1997 and 2010, California paid doctors nearly $150,000 to perform the procedures. In California, it's all right to use state money to fund sterilizations in prison, so long as a medical review committee approves each procedure case by case. But records show that review process simply didn't happen in that four-year gap between 2006 and 2010. The Atlantic Wire cites America's long and gruesome history of forced sterilizations in prisons. It's against the law to pressure a female inmate to have the procedure during labor or childbirth, and you can't use federal funding to pay for the procedure in a prison because of worries that the funding would make inmates feel like they had to do it.
This baby boy became a citizen 1 minute ago. His mother does not have immigration papers.
We're told they should be sterilized to save taxpayers' welfare.
Something drastic must be done about population growth.
The doctor walked in and said, "We cut your tubes," and I said, "Why?" He goes, "Well, you signed for it." I said, "Me?" I go, "I don't remember nothing." And I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell anybody.
They were extremely fearful, being told that you need an emergency cesarean section. You can feel blood pouring down your leg. At that time, signing a consent for a tubal ligation.
This is the emergency department in Los Angeles County, USC Medical Center.
Some of them signed right in the midst of labor. Some of them don't even remember signing. Here I is, this young lawyer, and for the first time telling him, "Do you know that you've been sterilized?"
We are suing HEW for non-compliance or non-enforcement of the sterilization regulations.
It was just the beginning of the emergence of the civil rights movement in the Latino community.
We were talking about abortion rights, all of the issues of feminism at that time. The idea that somebody could be forcibly sterilized like seemed like something out of a mental institution out of the 1920s.
The way I felt when I was young, it doesn't change the way I feel in my heart now that I'm older. But it's there all the time. It's like when you bury somebody, you're always going to carry it on your head.
I want to jump on over to Althea, news director of KBU Radio, and then Cecil. And thank you for bringing up what is happening in California as well. Althea?
Yes. So Professor Johnson touched on some of the history, but there's even more than what he brought up, and you know, very aptly pointed out that this history of hysterectomies are often given to poor women of color who are considered undesirable. In the 1970s, 70,000 Native women were sterilized, and keep in mind that's the same time that Roe v. Wade was happening. White women in America were having an expansion of their reproductive rights. And Native women at that time, about 25% of those at childbearing age were sterilized by 1976. Some of the Mexican American women in the 1920s and 50s were mentioned by Professor Johnson. They were often coerced in order to get medical care for their children. They were coerced into getting hysterectomies after the fact. Between the 1930s and the 1970s, about a third of Puerto Rican women were sterilized in mass eugenics campaigns. This is while the United States was in charge in Puerto Rico. In 1973, two Black sisters, Minnie and Mary Ralph, were sterilized under the guise of getting birth control shots, which their case actually brought attention to the U.S. government campaign to sterilize poor Black women.
On June 27th, 1973, a lawsuit was filed that brought national attention to the issue of racially targeted sterilization abuse. In the late 1960s and into the 70s, civil rights activists noticed a widespread trend among women of color. It was sterilization. In June of 73, the Ralph sisters, 14-year-old Minnie Lee and 12-year-old Mary Alice, who was mentally disabled, were sterilized without their knowledge or consent. These African-American girls had the procedure done at a Montgomery, Alabama family planning clinic that received federal funds. Clinic workers deceived the girl's illiterate mother into believing that she was consenting to the girls getting birth control shots. 2 years earlier, the Ralph sisters had been given birth control injections as part of an experimental trial, again, without their consent. After the federal government ended that trial, the clinic nurses decided that the girls should be sterilized. The girls were targeted for sterilization because they were poor, black, and living in public housing. After the procedure, the girls revealed to their parents that instead of receiving shots, they had undergone surgery. On June 27th, with the assistance of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Ralph family sued the clinic and the Office of Economic Opportunity, which provided it with federal funding. The district court found an estimated 100,000 to 150,000 poor people were sterilized annually under federally funded programs. The lawsuit led to the requirement that doctors obtain informed consent before performing sterilization procedures.
You know, obviously what's been in the news lately brings to mind all of these things, even though it kind of seems like a faraway idea. But in 2010, as Professor Johnson mentioned, women in California prisons were forcibly sterilized. In 2015, a judge in Tennessee offered probation in exchange for sterilization. And of course, in 2020, immigrant women have been sterilized without their consent in ICE facilities in Georgia. And, you know, as of recording, we have a certain amount of information about the conditions under which that happened. It was women, their symptoms were overblown, perhaps, that there were other avenues of treatment that would be appropriate for them other than a hysterectomy, that there was one doctor in particular who was eager to perform these things. They were not informed. They were not given proper translations. But this is something that has been happening. And thinking about it, I get a real sick feeling in my stomach. The idea of coming out of anesthesia and not knowing what happened to you. And that, like, hysterectomies themselves are an option for women when they are informed that that's what the kind of decision that they want to make for themselves. Making that decision for someone else, especially someone who may be in a situation where they don't have total information or they're coerced, you are taking away their future and their ability to make those choices for themselves. And that's so much of reproductive justice, which is a term that was coined by Black women, is not just like the access to contraceptives, but also the freedom to choose when and where you want to use them and having support to make the choices that are right for that person.
Nia Gray, Faith Reporter, Trick or Treat.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was reading the article about what was happening at the Irwin County Detention Center, I was really surprised to find that the doctor, aka the uterus collector, that ended up being his nickname, was actually an Indian immigrant himself that studied in India. So I am looking at the news to see more information, because I was really happy and proud of the nurse that was the whistleblower, that in addition to taking women's uteruses, they were also downplaying the need for COVID testing, and the medical staff didn't believe the women, or they yelled at them when they wanted to get treated for their pre-existing conditions, as well as if they reported any pain. And so I went another way. I definitely love what Professor Johnson and Althea said, and I dug a little bit deeper because I was thinking, oh, you know, this is just sort of the backwards South. But in my research, finding out that California, which seems to be a progressive state, has this really negative and evil history that was of much interest of Hitler to use as a blueprint for his own eugenics, which was actually legal in Germany, is that what are the effects that we see that today? And when I see the Hispanic women asking for pain meds and they don't give it to them, eugenics isn't always just sterilization. It was also perpetrated by scientists such as or scientists who studied in prestigious universities like Stanford. And what they did is they would espouse this race theory and race science to twist this data to serve their racist needs. And that legacy lives on today. So women of color, whether they're Hispanic or African American, are three to four times more likely than their white peers to die from pregnancy-related complications. We've heard from Beyonce, we've heard from lots of celebrities where they feel like they almost died. Well, there were these myths that were perpetrated with this pseudoscience that theorized that, you know, Black people are more durable. They don't feel pain like white people do, so they don't need painkillers, or they treat us in a different way. And so these racist precepts really do sneak in and inform our diagnoses and our treatments even today as people of color. So just reading that article about Dr. Admin really brought that to life, that even today with this racist medicine, this is what they've been doing for years.
At the edge of Central Park in Manhattan, there's a bronze statue of a doctor named James Marion Sims, whose brilliant achievement carried the fame of American surgery throughout the entire world. He's the guy who created the vaginal speculum, an instrument gynecologists use for examination. He pioneered the surgical repair for fistula, a complication from childbirth, and became known as the father of modern gynecology. But that brilliant achievement was the result of a series of excruciating experimental surgeries that he conducted on enslaved women. In a lot of ways, Sims epitomizes the story of American medicine for Black women. It's a system that's failing them to this day. From infant mortality to life expectancy, the racial disparities in healthcare are staggering. The gulf between Black and white might be widest when we look at maternal mortality, with Black women 3 to 4 times more likely to die in connection with pregnancy or birth than white women. And that divide can be traced back to doctors like Sims, who contributed to a long, largely overlooked history of institutional racism in medicine.
Trying to understand a historical problem without knowing its history is like trying to treat a patient without eliciting a thorough medical history. You're doomed to failure.
That's Harriet Washington, a medical ethicist and author who chronicled the intersection of race and medicine in her book, Medical Apartheid. While many of the stark racial disparities in healthcare can be attributed to environmental and economic factors like access to good healthcare, studies show that minority patients tend to receive a lower quality of care than non-minorities, even when they have the same types of health insurance or the same ability to pay for care.
As African Americans, we've been abused for so long, consistently by the system. Why should we trust it? Why should we go to it when ill? And that's iatrophobia. That's a fear of the healer. You know, inculcated by the behavior of those healers, unfortunately.
It starts with slavery. Doctors relied on slave owners for financial stability. They accompanied plantation masters to auctions to verify the fitness of slaves and were called in to treat sick slaves to protect their owners' investments. In 1807, Congress abolished the importation of slaves and in turn pushed Black women to have more children, to essentially breed slaves. Founding Father Thomas Jefferson later wrote, "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm." Around the 1830s, the abolitionist movement led to the rise of what was called Negro medicine, or efforts to identify Black inferiority to justify slavery. And there were polygenists who tried to use both science and the Bible to find proof that races evolved from different origins. The 1830s also marked the beginning of recorded experimentation on Black women's bodies. One doctor performed experimental C-sections on slaves. Another one perfected the dangerous ovariotomy, or removal of an ovary, by testing the procedure on slave women. In fact, half the original articles in the 1836 Southern Medical and Surgical Journal dealt with experiments on Black people. And then, of course, there was James Marion Sims, whose reputation is etched in history and on that statue in Central Park. Between 1845 and 1849, Sims began performing experimental surgeries on a 17-year-old slave named Anarka. He eventually performed 30 operations on Anarka and more surgeries on about 11 other female slaves. When his male colleagues could no longer bear to assist him in inflicting pain on the women, the slaves took turns restraining one another. Yet paintings depicting Sims, Anarka, and other slave women presented a subdued version of his experiments. Even though anesthesia was introduced in 1846, Sims chose not to use it for his experimentation with slaves. His practices echoed one of the most prevalent and dangerous beliefs in medicine at the time, that Black people did not feel pain or anxiety. This book from 1851, titled The Natural History of Human Species, claimed the American dark races bear with indifference tortures insupportable to a white man. Studies released as recently as last year demonstrate that Black people are less likely to be treated for pain, particularly in the ER. There's even one from a children's hospital that found the same to be true for kids. And just this year, Pearson Education, a leading educational publisher, issued an apology and recalled nursing textbooks that included racist stereotypes, like this section that said Black people often report higher pain intensity than other cultures.
Well, what does it mean when you say that someone doesn't feel pain? Among other things, you're speaking about their humanity. These are all part of that suite of beliefs emanating from the 19th century that we still have not shaken off. Despite all our knowledge and sophistication, they're deeply ingrained.
Doctors like Sims might fit the Dr. Frankenstein stereotype, but they weren't outliers. Historically, Southern doctors who used Black bodies for troubling experiments were the norm.
It's a very common question. How can we judge our forebears? You know, those guys in the 18th century who practiced medicine the way that appalls us today. You know, we think, how could you do that? I did not judge the practitioners based on our own ethics. I judged them based on the ethics of their time. It was not acceptable back then. We just did not hear from the people who protested against it.
After the Civil War ended, the 1900s brought a wave of immigrants to the U.S. It sparked a race panic and coincided with the birth of the American eugenics movement. One of the movement's key objectives was to reduce the childbearing potential of the poor and disabled. Leaders included birth control pioneer and Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger, who eventually devised the controversial Negro Project, or family planning centers that pushed birth control in the Black South. It was a project that even garnered support from W.E.B. Du Bois, a founder of the NAACP, who wrote that Black people bred carelessly and disastrously. By the mid-1930s, more than half the states passed pro-sterilization laws. And often, sterilization was forced. In 1961, future civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer went to the hospital to have a tumor removed, but was subjected to a hysterectomy without consent. The procedure, which rendered women infertile without their knowledge, was so common in the South that Hamer is said to have dubbed it the Mississippi appendectomy.
African-American babies were no longer economically valuable. And African Americans themselves had gone from being a resource to a nuisance.
In June of 1973, the SPLC uncovered 100 to 150,000 cases of women who had been sterilized with federal funds in Alabama. Half the women were Black. In recent decades, women of color continue to be exposed to dubious reproductive health programs. In December 1990, the FDA approved a contraceptive called Norplant, and it was selectively marketed to Black teenagers in Baltimore schools.
You know, one of the current birth control methods now in the United States is Norplant.
Norplant fans like David Duke, the former KKK Grand Wizard, even introduced legislation to give women on welfare an annual reward of $100 if they agreed to get Norplant.
And it's time we start to encourage welfare mothers to be responsible.
That bill never passed, but the implant ignited a debate on whether long-term contraception, like Norplant that lasted 5 years, could be used as a form of social engineering when pushed to specific communities. Today, as we continue to lose Black mothers at alarming rates, a deeper look at the past may be a good step towards creating a more equitable healthcare system.
Cecil?
Yes, just following up on what our Faith reporter said. This is something they've been doing for years. And I would commend to our listener to pick up and read Isabel Wilkinson's new volume, Caste, in which she compares our system in the United States with the caste system in India and Nazi Germany. And one thing that we find out that we touch upon, some of the other commentators have touched upon, is that the United States system was studied by the Nazis in terms of our caste system in the United States. And they studied it, and to some extent, they say that our system was so harsh that they couldn't do things as harsh as we did. So just think about that for a moment. And this history of medical malpractice is something that is rooted since the first European colonizers came to these shores, in which indigenous people, indigenous women were attacked and mistreated and raped, as well as those who came over force in ships as slaves, and the mistreatment that occurred from those people as well, to those people as well. This history of medical malpractice towards people of color is something that we are well aware of, and not only are those examples that have been pointed out most recently, but certainly in the Black community, the Tuskegee syphilis study is something that resides in our history and in our memories.
In July of 1972, the Washington Star newspaper broke the story about the controversial Tuskegee Institute syphilis experiment. For 40 years, from 1932 until 1972, the U.S. Public Health Service, in partnership with Tuskegee, secretly studied the effects of untreated syphilis in African-American men in Alabama. 600 Black men, 399 with syphilis and 201 without the disease, were induced to participate in the experiment. Nearly all of them were poorly educated, impoverished sharecroppers. In exchange for participating, they were promised free medical exams, hot meals, and a burial stipend. The men with syphilis were not told they were infected and were not treated, even after penicillin was discovered to be an effective cure for the disease in the 1940s. Over the course of the experiment, 128 participants died of syphilis or syphilis-related complications. In 1972, when the paper exposed the details, the experiment was still ongoing. It incited public outrage over the unethical treatment of the participants, which led to the experiment's termination that November. The following year, the NAACP filed suit on behalf of the survivors. The federal government settled the lawsuit for $10 million. It also agreed to provide survivors and their infected family members with free medical services.
And finally, what I would like to say is, I think it's ironic that when we hear so much of those who want to prevent women from making medical decisions for their own bodies, the party that claims to be pro-life, that they are strangely silent when women are enduring such horrible treatments. Where's the uproar? Where's the cry out for life? This is a lasting and sad legacy of our country, and we must shout out and speak up for those who are the victims of this genocide.
So Cecil, while I have you on mic, this is our Trick or Treat show. What didn't we talk about?
Oh, well, you know, what? One thing we did not talk about, and maybe this will be something that unfortunately will go on as long as you have this program, I want just to acknowledge Jonathan Pryce, who is maybe the most recent example of a police killing, a man who was trying to break up a fight, and the police came and just attacked, killed him.
Mr. Price was unarmed. He was non-aggressive and he had his hands up.
Witnesses say Price was trying to break up a domestic dispute at a gas station. Tonight, the Texas Ranger shedding new light on the fatal encounter, saying in a statement, Officer Lucas attempted to detain Price, who resisted in a non-threatening posture and began walking away.
Investigators confirm witness accounts of what happened next, saying Lucas deployed his taser on Price in this gas station parking lot, then drew his service weapon, firing on Price, who died in a nearby hospital.
The Rangers say their preliminary investigation shows the actions of Officer Lucas were not objectionably reasonable. The district attorney not commenting on the facts of the case amid the ongoing investigation. Support for the family now pouring into this small town. Hundreds gathering last night to honor Jonathan's life with peaceful calls for justice. Price described as a pillar of his community. The 31-year-old worked for the city and as a personal trainer, choosing to move back home from Dallas to help his mother.
So we did not talk about Jonathan Price, and we need to pay attention to see what happens. Fortunately, the police who killed him was arrested. We just have to place on a $1 million bond, and he remains in jail. But we just have to wait to see whether or not justice will be done for Jonathan Price's family.
So I want to go to Professor Johnson and then Althea, then ended up with our face reporter. Let me start with you, Professor Johnson. What didn't we talk about?
One thing that we didn't talk about that I actually think relates to the subject, you know, that has been our topic here, is the watchdog report that came out that says the senior Department of Justice officials were directly involved in removing children from their parents, children that were babies that were still nursing, even that young. And they directly tied Jeff Sessions, who was the attorney general at the time, and they also have tied Rob Rosenstein into making a very deliberate decision to do this. So there is also talk that this could be something that could be investigated or taken to an international court in terms of crimes against humanity.
Althea and then Nia.
We didn't quite get to delve all the way into how this all ties into the system of mass incarceration. It's no coincidence that the most recent instances of this happening in prison in Colorado and ICE detention centers in Georgia are happening in those situations.
Follow-up question, Althea. You mean the forced sterilization is part of the whole incarceration movement?
I think that the controlling of people's futures through mass incarceration and through forced sterilization and the role that incarceration plays in the continuation of this practice, whereas it may seem outdated and wrong in any other context, I think is important to consider.
Thank you for the clarification. Final thoughts, Faith reporter Nia Gray, what didn't we talk about?
Well, tonight is the vice presidential debate, so I'm sure we'll have a lot of content to talk about next week. And also, there was a recent article by Eric Trump about his dad claiming that Donald Trump saved Christianity from Democratic atheists. And I think maybe that's a good topic for the future of just how or why Christians continue, or so-called Christians continue, to be manipulated by the Republican Party, how the white evangelical movement has been completely and totally hijacked.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator,
from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
This is our Trick or Treat show. The Treat, making society better, or offering you free medical procedures, or getting your probation shortened, or your criminal sentences shortened. The Trick. You are sterilized. Your uterus is removed, or you have a vasectomy. Forced sterilization is back in the news. For undocumented human beings, people of color, women who were incarcerated, and men to reduce their prison time. This is a true horror story. We do not need to make up horror stories when our history in America, past and present, is terrifying enough. Let's talk about race. Trick or treat. Forced sterilization continues in America.
On May 15th, Judge Benningfield issued this standing order. Any inmate who completes a neonatal health class then has an option. Female inmates can get a free Nexplanon birth control implant in their arm. Male inmates can get a free vasectomy. They will then be given 30 days credit toward their jail time.
What I'm hoping to do is help them start thinking about taking responsibility for themselves.
So far, 32 women in the jail have gotten the birth control implant, which lasts for 4 years. 38 men are waiting to get vasectomies.
And so I hope to encourage them to at some point finally take, you know, personal responsibility and to give them a chance if when they do get out not to be burdened again with, you know, additional children.
Should inmates get reduced jail time for getting a vasectomy?
No.
District Attorney Bryant Dunaway has major concerns.
I just think that it's something that those decisions are personal in nature, and I think that's just something that the court system should not encourage nor mandate.
This is Nia Gray, and welcome to The Faith Report, where evangelism meets social justice. In an NBC article, a recent survey found that racism among white Christians is higher than among the non-religious. Over the past few months, we've seen an increase in Black Lives Matter protests, followed by the white nationalist backlash in the form of hate crime attacks on Black and brown protesters, motorists, and essential workers of color. But who could forget the white supremacist couple arrested for a July 22nd hate crime after they attacked a car with a shovel and screamed, "Only white lives matter"? Or the daily news story of a white person captured on film racially profiling a person of color at an apartment or a gym. And then finally, who can forget the white woman who was videotaped lying to the police when confronted by a Black man in Central Park to not walk her dog in a designated area? These quote-unquote Karen videos are daily examples of blatant racism where the police are weaponized against Black people. Yet, the white evangelical Christians are on the sidelines, with no mention of this ungodly behavior. Well, it turns out that some white Christians deny the very existence of racism, specifically the treatment of African Americans by law enforcement. White Christians seem to have displaced anger about Black Lives Matter protesters and refer to them not as the democratic demonstrations by citizens who have the right to protest or peacefully assemble. Nope, these so-called ambassadors of Christ call them riots, which is demonized legitimate protesters who are calling for accountability for the murder of Black people at the hand of police. The Public Religion Research Institute American Values Survey, released in November 2019, had a devastating finding. 73% of white mainline Protestants, effectively white Christians, said they believe that the killings of African American men by the police are isolated incidents, which stands in sharp contrast to the 82% of Black Protestants who believe these incidents are part of a broader pattern of how police treat minorities. The truth about how America as a nation has treated Black people in education, employment, housing, healthcare, and hate crimes has been well documented. But despite this, there are many in the church that dispute this truth. So how can white Christian Americans vehemently argue against the American double standard for the treatment of Black people in law enforcement and flat out deny that racism still exists? Also, according to the same survey, white Christians as a whole are less likely to believe the experiences of Black Americans than non-white Christians. A shameful indictment of a church that's either biblically illiterate or blatantly ignoring God's word for their personal benefit. The Bible has a clear anti-racist message. Racism for non-believers is a moral issue. For people of faith, it's more than a moral evil. It's a sin. Racism mocks the very words of Jesus. Treat others the way you would have them treat you. Indeed, racism is more than a disregard of the words of Jesus. It is a denial of the truth of God's word in Genesis that announces all men and women are created in God's image. White Christians who sit in church and give an amen when the pastor quotes Galatians 3, 26-29, which says, "So in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ." But then when they get out of the pews and go back out to their friends, family, and workplace, they perpetuate racial stereotypes and slurs in everyday conversations, deny systemic racism, support the most openly racist president in U.S. history, who supports white supremacy and white militia, orders immigrant children in cages, and encourages violence against civil rights groups like Black Lives Matter. You watch the police murder Black people on video and then desperately look for justification. "Well, he must have committed a crime," or "he should have been more respectful to the police officer." Anyone who reads the Bible can see concepts of justice and community care in all 66 books. The New Testament is full of examples of Jesus reaching out to the poor, the disenfranchised, and different ethnic groups of that day, while he openly and scathingly criticized the Pharisees, who were the wealthy religious power of the time. Social justice is a Christian agenda, not a liberal agenda. I believe the solution for racism and hate is in God's word. In a 2017 Pew Research study, found that reading the Bible is seen as an afterthought for 42% of self-identified American Christians. Anyone who reads the Bible can see concepts of justice and community care in all 66 books. The New Testament is full of examples of Jesus reaching out to the poor, the disenfranchised, and different ethnic groups, while he openly and scathingly criticized the Pharisees, who were the wealthy religious power of the day. Social justice is a Christian agenda, not a liberal agenda. I personally believe the solution for racism and hate is in God's word. But a 2017 Pew Research study found that reading the Bible is seen as an afterthought for 42% of self-identified American Christians. Perhaps that's why racism is so pervasive in the church. Christians don't even read the Bible. The most shuddering and painful fact I discovered in my research is a very clear pattern whereby all three of the major white Christian subgroups, evangelical, mainline, and Catholic, ended up scoring pretty high on the racism index. While the same racism index found white, religiously unaffiliated Americans scored lower. So the non-religious, non-church attending hold less racist views than white Christians who claim to follow Jesus. This has been your Faith Report.
Have you lost your job due to the public policing of people of color? Have you called 911 on a Black child who mowed part of the wrong yard? Or a Black family eating at Subway? Have you called 911 on an 8-year-old Black girl selling bottled water? Or a woman using the private pool in her gated community? Or how about calling 911 on a group of Black women on a golf course or in a parking lot? Well, not to worry, because there's work for you in the Trump administration. So don't worry, Permit Patty, Pool Patrol Paula, Corner Store Caroline, Barbecue Becky, or Fast Draw McTyler. You can work for us. Calling the police on people of color is our right when things do not look right, such as seeing any people of color in public. Any people of color in our parking lot, on the golf course, swimming pools, or in our neighborhoods. Unless, of course, they are bouncing, throwing, or kicking some sort of ball. The social stigma of being considered a bigot does not matter to the Trump administration. So there's no need to worry about the evidence that racial prejudice drives police calls. Because people of color, especially black people, are widely perceived as being aggressive simply due to their race. So say goodbye to the unemployment line and the embarrassment. Work for the Trump administration and feel free to call 911 on that black kid that just moved next door. Question those Hispanics who are working in your building and not to worry when the police shoots a black man holding a cell phone. White supervision of the presence of people of color is very American, and we in the Trump administration are very American.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you.
Race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race. Coming up on Let's Talk About Race is our segment, Book Love.
If there is no other nonfiction book you read in this year of 2020, a year in which we as Americans have shared an existential crisis with the entire world and came out on the bottom and experienced a collective epiphany, let it be Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. There was Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow that blew the covers off an essentially new system of unjust imprisonment and disenfranchisement of black and brown people. And there have been a plethora of exceptional books that describe and explain racial oppression in the United States, and some even offer step-by-step remedies, describing racism as the COVID 1619 in its capture and destruction of innocent lives in a myriad of ways. But I would argue that no work has risen to the level of scholarship intertwined with the innovative brilliance of Wilkerson's new book, Caste. Like the loudest boom of thunder imaginable, it disrupts the way we think, talk, and understand how race actually functions in American society. Wilkerson's intent is courageous, lofty, and incredibly clear, like the Albert Einstein quote in her epigraph. If the majority knew of the root of this evil, then the road to its cure would not be long. This is not the first time Wilkerson has discarded the worn-out, confused, and indicting term of racism. She did so as well in her first book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, a Pulitzer Prize winner about black people fleeing the terror of the caste system of Jim Crow. In that phenomenal work, she meticulously used the word caste, never racist or racism. A caste system, Wilkerson writes, is an artificial construction, a fixed and embedded ranking of human value that sets the presumed supremacy of one group against the presumed inferiority of other groups on the basis of ancestry and often immutable traits. Traits that would be neutral in the abstract but are ascribed life and death meaning in a hierarchy favoring the dominant caste whose forebears designed it. A caste system uses rigid, often arbitrary boundaries to keep the ranked groupings apart, distinct from one another, and in their assigned places. Throughout human history, three caste systems have stood out. The tragically accelerated, chilling, and officially vanquished caste system of Nazi Germany. The lingering, millennia-long caste system of India. And the shape-shifting, unspoken, race-based caste pyramided in the United States. Each version relied on stigmatizing those deemed inferior to justify the dehumanization necessary to keep the lowest ranked people at the bottom and to rationalize the protocols of enforcement. A caste system endures because it is often justified as divine will originating from sacred text or the presumed laws of nature, reinforced throughout the culture and passed down through the generations. Yet Wilkerson is more interested in showing than telling, and caste is embellished with unforgettable anecdotes of how our American caste system operates. The facts that she has gathered reveal undeniable truths that can undo the straitjacket of racism we find ourselves bound within, unable to see a way forward, especially when Wilkerson lays out with such clarity how our caste system is comparable with India and the shocking evidence of how German eugenicists turned to American eugenicists and the system of Jim Crow when developing laws and policies to enforce ethnic separations in rising Nazi Germany. This book is not perfect, no book is, except perhaps The Color Purple. But jokes aside, this is truly a transformative work that will not only be impactful for anyone who reads it, but like Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, changed our understanding like no book had before of who we are as Americans when it was published in 2010. 10 years later, in 2020, this year that feels like a decade, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents may help us dismantle this oppressive monster we've inherited that is blocking real human progress toward freedom for all human beings.
We have been trained and socialized to see ourselves by what is defined in our country and has been defined for 400 years as race, the division of people on the basis of what they look like primarily, which was essentially the view of what one's ancestry might have been. And one of the things that brought me to this book is that I wrote a book before, and my first book was The Warmth of Other Suns. And that book was about the outpouring, the migration of 6 million African Americans from the Jim Crow South, essentially defecting what I came to call a caste system. And that was because the word racism that we are so accustomed to using did not seem sufficient to capture the world as it existed in that way, the hierarchies into which people have been born, the multi-layered forms of controlling and repressing people on the basis of what they look like, this artificial hierarchy. And so that's how I came to the use of the term caste in reference to the United States.
This is our Trick or Treat show. The treat, making society better, or offering you free medical procedures, or getting your probation shortened, or your criminal sentences shortened. The trick.
You are sterilized.
Your uterus is removed, or you have a vasectomy. Forced sterilization is back in the news. For undocumented human beings, people of color, women who were incarcerated, and men to reduce their prison time. We do not need to make up horror stories when our history in America, past and present, is terrifying enough. Let's talk about race. Trick or treat. Forced sterilization continues in America.
I've been nursing at Irwin County Detention Center for the past 9 months this time go around. I've seen the conditions inside the facility throughout times passing. I decided to become a whistleblower after this last round with COVID-19.
You have detained women. I had several detained women on numerous occasions that would come to me and say, "Miss Wooten, I had a hysterectomy. Why?" I had no answers as to why they had those procedures. And one lady walked up to me here this last time around between October of 19 until July the 2nd. And she said, "What is he? Is he the uterus collector? Does he collect uteruses?" And I asked her, "What does she mean?" And she says, "Everybody that I talked to has had a hysterectomy. And you just don't know what to say." I mean, I don't have a answer for why that they would come to me and they would say, "Is he the uterus collector?"
You have good genes, you know that, right? You have good genes. A lot of it's about the genes, isn't it? Don't you believe? The racehorse theory, you think we're so different? You have good genes in Minnesota.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at Translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and Translator K282BH.